Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to Watch Less, Complex's podcast about movie and TV culture. As always, it's Cal, deputy editor at Complex's Pop Culture Vertical. The homie Fraser Tharp, Summerman's in the building. It is summertime. Finally. It's officially summertime. You good?
Well, this is, I can't really say I'm activated right now. Like, yeah. Halfway stuck inside.
You should
it's
not
a
be
weird
activated.
Season.
You definitely should not be activated.
I'm not at my full strength.
I'm hoping that's because you're not getting outside and not because you're contracting anything. Because it's bad out there. So people, like they say in the 90s when I was growing up, they were practicing safe sex and they still do. But they were promoting safe sex and they said strap up. And it's like now it's just like mask on. You got to at the very least just keep a goddamn mask on you. Like we can't let this thing keep going. But anyway,
oh, hell yeah.
This week we have a very interesting conversation. Because we didn't think it made any sense to do a whole feature on the movies that came out in 2020 because of the aforementioned coronavirus shutting down still shutting down theaters. We don't know if Tenet's going to make its August 15th date yet.
We talk about that.
Yeah, we don't know.
That's still such a crazy statement to say to me.
But because of that, it's instead of trying to cobble together a feature with legit like 7 films on it, we wanted to open up the conversation. We get deep into, you know, our picks, you know, not firm picks, but, you know, a very loose organization of like our top 5 to top 10 best films that we've seen so far. A real discussion about some of the worst films we've seen, you know, a little bit about our pleasant surprises and then ultimately some things that were, you know, kind of disappointing, as well as, again, trying to figure out what the future is going to hold for at least 2020 in cinema and with award season, let alone what it'll be in the future. But
I think it's a full-on breakdown.
Yeah, it's
the year movies so far. All the rare highs and the mini lows.
We haven't forgotten about you. You definitely saw the best TV shows of 2020 so far feature, but this is our supplement to that with a conversation about film. But I think before we get into that, we can't start a podcast without reflecting on some of the unfortunate, like tragic news that's happened over the last weekend. I think at the top of everybody's conversation with that is Naya Rivera. Her body was found. It was recovered. She was 33 years old. She is, you know, was found dead.
Glee was a first for a lot of different things, but I think her character was I believe bisexual.
Yeah.
On the show, and that did a lot for representation at the time, especially given that it's it was a teen show essentially. So you're getting a lot of people in their formative years, seeing some very much needed reflection of themselves.
Yeah, I think
I've been seeing that on Twitter a lot. A lot of people who really related to her when they were coming up
were
just absolutely crushed right now.
Yeah, the impact, and it's crazy because it's that show dropped relatively late in her career. It's funny, she was essentially like a child actress. She worked in episodes of Family Matters. She was on Fresh Prince.
There was a lot of stuff.
Yeah, she did Fresh Prince, a couple episodes of The Smart Guy. She had like 11 episodes of The Bernie Mac Show. She was, really getting in on it was dope to see that it was a lot of like some of the better black sitcoms that she was, able to, have recurring roles on. Before the one-time
Complex cover star too.
Yeah, August, September 2013. Shouts out to Tara Aquino for that. I remember that feature being really dope. We were talking before we were recording about how, that it's one of those covers that, some of us some mark their time starting at Complex around the time that that cover dropped. I remember for me, you know, going to work at a site that, you know, was having me work digital, but still seeing the magazine operation happen and seeing that particular issue with the way the photos are spread out. She's playing poker with herself. And I don't know, it's a really dope photo. You could find it. Just Google it. You know, those Complex covers were classic.
Yeah, I was going to say that it's one of those, like, we've done, there's a time when we used to do so many covers because it was flipped.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot to sift through, and you definitely forget a few. But once I remembered that she did have a cover, the image came back to me immediately. It's definitely one of our better images for sure.
I think I'm going to have to see. Motif. I've got a stack of mags that I've collected since I've been. I got to see if I have that one. It's probably in my bedroom. But anyway, you know, rest in peace to Naya Rivera.
It's kind of crazy. You think about how in the years after Glee, you know, in some regards, she kind of became known for like her personal life intruding on her career. But I think we had seen her get to the other side of that. And she was, you know, writing memoirs and lining up new roles and shit. So,
and just being a mom, you know, she had a whole son. Like, you know, I think she was embracing, because I don't think her career ended. Yeah, she was doing, she did 20 episodes of that Step Up show that was on YouTube. It was like direct to YouTube. I think it was, yeah, they said she did 20 episodes and the third season was in production at the time of her death. So if you're a fan of that show, you're probably, you know, seriously crushed, but also B, it'll be, you know, I imagine there might be some type of tribute episode, like similar to what they did for like Luke Perry when he passed on. They did a whole episode for him on Riverdale. I'm tying him into the story and really, and throughout the season, giving him his props as Archie's father within the storyline. So, you know, be on the lookout for things like that. Hers wasn't the only tragic news. You know, rest in peace to Kelly Preston.
Damn.
Yeah, she recently passed as well. She
also relatively young, 57 from 57. Breast cancer.
Yeah, she'd been battling breast cancer for a couple of years, right?
A 2-year battle, but I guess it still came as a shock to most people because they didn't. I was reading that they didn't really publicize it.
No, yeah, I don't think I'd heard much about whatever she was. I honestly, I'd only really heard her name in passing in regards to just like when John Travolta was doing anything in the news. I don't know how active she'd been, and now. You know, I guess, you know, a lot of us are understanding why and learning why. So, yeah, rest in peace to her. As well as Nick Cordero. It feels like once a week I'm going to reference Talking Sopranos, but they mentioned him. He passed at the age of 41. Most known for a lot of work he done on Broadway. I think he played Sonny in the Broadway rendition of A Bronx Tale from 2016 to 2018. He done a little bit of TV and film, but I think it's mostly the Broadway stuff. He actually got nominated for a Tony for his work in Bullets Over Broadway. And he died at 41 from COVID complications, which is sad. Jesus. I think I believe there is a GoFundMe set up for his wife. And I don't know. I know he has at least a child. I don't know how many people are in his family, but they set up a GoFundMe for that. They were talking about that. They seemed like he was a stand-up dude. Steve and Michael Imperioli were really, it seemed like they were really friendly with him. So, you know, rest in peace to him as well.
And on top of that, we also lost Grant Imahara, the host of MythBusters, at 49 to a brain aneurysm. So definitely a heavy week.
Yeah, it's a lot going on.
Heavy week in Hollywood.
All right, again, our condolences from the Watch List podcast and the Complex Networks family. On a lighter note, we do have the year in movies in 2020 to look at. We're going to get into a quick break. And after that, we'll get into our discussion about the best movies of 2020 so far.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So we're past actually the middle of the year. We're 2020, quite possibly one of the most hellacious years in recent memory, probably in my lifetime. I don't think I've had a year start off as terribly as this one has. Although I love having conversations with you every week about movies and TV, Frazier.
Thanks, Cal.
Hey, no problem. No problem at all. You the homie.
Upcoming we've been birthday. Having we for years.
We yeah, no, big facts. Big facts. I'm wondering, we're gonna have to table this, but we should probably do something special for your birthday, which is coming soon on the pod. I don't know what it is. I'll think about it on the side. Anyway.
Review The Mummy.
We might need to. That'll be the one live watch. It'll be Instagram Live. We'll be watching The Mummy with the birthday boy, Big Frage. That'll be the only time I call him Big Frage. No, the corona jacked up the year in movies early. We talked about it before, but it was our South by Southwest prep is really the start of the downfall of the movie industry in 2020. It's to the point where I'm kind of surprised that we're even still able to talk about there being good movies that came out this year. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, TV hasn't really been hit yet. That's another conversation that people are starting to have about when we're going to run out of TV, because you know, that stockpile is going to dry up soon, but movies really got hit, man. I think it's crazy to look at. So just to give the people context too, we didn't even do a list on the site.
You couldn't.
This year, because it just seemed kind of pointless.
Of what came out, I mean, again, to put things into context, Bad Boys for Life is still the top grossing film of 2020. That film came out around the end of February.
And that's no shade to Bad Boys.
It's no shade at all. But it's
absolutely wild that, like, January is considered more or less a dumping ground, or
yes,
just like a slush pile of movies that are not expected to define the year in terms of acclaim or box office.
Mm-hmm.
So for a January, February movie, whenever that came out.
Yeah, I think it was end of January. Middle, right? Yeah, it came out before Sonic the Hedgehog, because Sonic the Hedgehog was, I think, Valentine's Day, and that's the second highest grossing movie domestically.
Yeah, so those two movies having those two spots in July is just absolutely nuts.
Yeah, we should have already had a Black Widow. Mulan would have come out. Bond would have come out. Fast 9 would have been out around this time. Like there would have been a bunch of films that would have dethroned,
obliterated
the latest. And again, no disrespect to Bad Boys, because a fun film. If we did a top 25 this year, it'd probably make the bottom half of that list. But either way, in July, it's a nutty situation. But I don't think we can let this time of this mid-year review of the year.
Mid-year review of a mid-year?
Yeah, facts. That title right there. I think I don't think there's any way we could look back at the last 6 months and not talk about movies at all, regardless of how terrible it's been.
Well, I think one thing to point out is that when you're looking at the normal structure of a year, kind of like I said, again, not trying to be shady to things that have come out already, but you're not really expecting, like last year when we sat down to make the 25 best films of 2019, very few of them were from the first quarter of the year.
100%.
Like, that's just not when the heat comes out usually.
April, so, May is usually when it really starts to kick off.
The other reason that it seems kind of futile to make a best list is that at a certain point, it's like, what is really best and what are you just putting on there to populate a list to get it to like a nice number of 15 or 20?
Yeah. A lot of cribbing is done. A lot of letting shit you wouldn't normally let slide because you want to
participation trophies.
You want to get this SEL. And I respect anybody's game. I respect anybody who has to hustle and make those lists. But a year like 2020, I think you have to be real with yourself. And I don't think we felt it made any, because there's shit that we've seen that we can't even talk about because the dates are still being pushed back. I want to talk about Saint Maud on this podcast. I hope we still get to when the film finally comes out. And I think that's probably part of it's indicative of a larger conversation about who's choosing to do VOD, video on demand, versus an A24 who's purposefully saying, hey,
we're not willing to let a film hit digital before it hits theaters. So we're down to, you know, fall back a little bit.
Yeah, and I gotta say, I do respect that, to be honest. Thinking of some of the films I've watched since quarantine started, and, you know, just to let people in on the weeds, we get sent like screening links, and sometimes they have like those little fucking Mission Impossible, this will detonate if you don't watch it in 24-hour, 48-hour type windows. So, you know, I don't know. I will be honest and say, as entitled as it might sound, I still don't enjoy watching new movies that way.
Well, and I think
you do lose a little bit of something. Even, you know, we're looking at films that were always going to be released at home first, right? Like Spike Lee's Five Bloods. Netflix would have had a media screening, probably, and it's Spike Lee. Like, they probably would have shelled out for some limited viewings in New York and L.A. for the general public to go see and enjoy. And that's a very big, loud movie that I would have loved to see on a big screen. And I think I look at something else like King of Staten Island, which, you know, we're going to talk about our best and our worst films. That kind of fell in the middle for me. I don't think it's that great. I don't think it's bad, but I do wonder if it would have held a little bit more of my attention being like a 2.5-hour movie about a guy that does nothing with his life in a screening room, you know?
Pete Davidson, 8 Mile. Yeah, I will say too, though, because I agree with you, but I do understand that, and it's no diss to you, because it's just how people take in movies. You're of the Nolan guard, I think, the idea that the best way to experience
the old guard,
you have to, shout out Charlize Theron, you have to watch movies that are made to be in theaters that first time. It's, as I'm getting older, and plus me just like generally being a hermit, I can watch most films on a screener link. If it's something like I don't know if I would want to watch a Black Widow.
Dude, I have this argument with our commenters all the time. Sometimes when I post things, we talked about this before on the pod, and just when we posted other things about the whole theater conversation, and so many people want Black Widow on Disney Plus. I'm like, dude, that's one of my least anticipated Marvel movies. So if it happened, whatever. But like, I don't want to see something like The Eternals on my TV, and I have a nice TV. You know, I have the sound bar. I have it as comfortable as I can possibly make it. And I do not want to do that if I don't have to. So I definitely respect people like Christopher Nolan, even though he's looking crazy and crazier by the day. I respect A24 for, you know, still trying to hold on to the theater experience and still, like, give us something to look forward to. Because this has gone on way longer than anyone ever really thought it would. Like, I don't think anyone in March, who is at least not a wild pessimist, I guess. No one in March thought that Tenet would be in trouble.
No.
For a release date.
It was too far gone to even consider. I think, it's an odd time. I think the other thing, which is, it's a totally other conversation at some point, but we're going to have to talk about the stigma of VOD, because I think that plays into a lot of it. It's a film like The King of Staten Island, it feels like it's easier to take that to VOD quicker than some of, like, Universal's doing that with The King of Staten Island. They're continuing to push back the dates for Candyman. I don't think they're gonna drop Yaya on VOD like they did Pete Davidson. And because the flip side to that too is, with a Disney, you could go on Disney Plus and get like a 4K HDR version of whatever they have on there. But they spent how much money making a Black Widow? They still have to recoup on a lot of those investments. So I think for those, you should expect a blockbuster to get pushed back for that reason alone.
And, you know, VOD does have a stigma. Some of it is unfair, I think.
A lot of it is. There's some good stuff that comes out.
And at the same time, I can't be mad at any other studio that doesn't, A, have the luxury of what A24 is doing, and just has chosen to do the opposite, because, you know, A24 is going to have their own problems when this does let up. It's like, me and you were talking about this the other day. Does that create a bottleneck effect after a while? Like, they're going to be sitting on a bunch of stuff that would have come out in April and then June. And now, like, is it going to be floodgates? And are these films still going to be in danger of cannibalizing each other?
Yeah.
How far does the calendar and the schedule get pushed back? It's all a mess. So I can't be mad at anyone for any decision they make because it's so unprecedented.
Yeah, nobody. And I take it back to like late March, early April when I was like soft just talking to some of the people we talked to in the industry, just trying to get an idea of what they were thinking. And a lot of the answers I got was just like no comment, or they don't want to talk about it right now. Cause I think it's still the machines are still too big to have them grind to a halt so abruptly, you know, and again, during a time where they'd be making the most cheese right now in terms of theater. So,
and a screenwriter told me in confidence that, you know, some of these films that have just been pushed back and haven't succumbed, for lack of a better word, to VOD,
mm-hmm.
are just, the pushback is just giving room to have that conversation.
Yes. Yes. You know? Yeah. Yeah. So. It's interesting. And again, these are a lot of convos we're probably at the table right now, because again, everything is still so new. Plus, we do still have to talk about the films that we have watched this year.
Yeah. I mean, hey, it's not all dire. It was still a good year.
Yeah.
So far, there's still some real gems out there, and there's gems out there for the public, and there's gems out there for us who are, you know, this is our line of work. Like, we're not trying to brag. We see some stuff early.
Yeah.
And we saw a couple heaters that are in the chamber right now.
Yeah.
And I think this is going to serve as a lesson, not to say that, you know, you never know when there could be a pandemic, mm. but I think this is a lesson to everyone, too, about those of us who got jaded about screenings. And are like, oh, yeah, I'll catch the next one. And
yeah,
turned out that could have been, A, your last theater experience, and B, the last chance before God knows when that you could see a hyped-ass movie.
Facts. I remember the days where we were waiting to see if, was it?
Imagine, how much would you pay? Oh, great. This is a great question. Okay. Knowing what you know now.
Mm-hmm.
Would you, and how much would you pay for screenings that would have been offered for Bond, Fast and Furious, and Candyman?
I mean, I know the other two in terms of just the conversation and the potential for content would be more important. I probably would have shelled out a good amount of money to see. I wanted to see Candyman after we got to screen the trailer. And there's
what a tease, right? Show us the whole movie there. You already got us at the Crosby.
There's that. There was the other like puppet trailer, and then I'm hearing that the movie got pushed back again into the middle of October. So we'll see. That might be a film that I might bear the elements to go see in theaters. Because
that's another great question.
Support Black causes.
What is, of the movies that have been pushed back, what is the movie that, you know, if it releases in a time where it's not like a 100% La La Land vaccine situation, what is the movie that you will brave the Rona to go see?
I hope,
whether that's in theaters, a screening, whatever.
Again, because I know the importance of certain things on the site, if I were to get word that there's a screening for, I want to say Tenet, but I think if we're still in this situation in November and I hear that there's a screening of Black Widow, regardless of how mid in the total universe I think the film's going to end up being, I have to go see it. I can't.
Hey,
not go
I want
to
all the bosses listening right now. You got to salute this. Give Cal that raise right now because he's putting the work first. He's talking about the content. I'm not even thinking about content when I go see Tenet with my mask and my bubble wrap on. I'm just thinking about the GOAT, Christopher Nolan.
It'll be 2 days later.
The content.
I'm hitting Fraser on GChat. So how was the film? My God. Crazy. All right. We've babbled along enough. I think we should get into.
Yeah. I mean, we were approaching the time of the year and when, you know, the real like A-list and not like grade A, not A-list in terms of celebrity, and the grade A films really start to hit. Mm-hmm. So, and again, when you factor in advanced screenings, we saw a little bit of them, but you know, I'm looking at, again, when I think of January and February and how you expect them to be like almost trashy B movies. Mm-hmm. Kristen Stewart was in this movie that I saw over the holiday break, just on like a random matinee wave called Underwater.
Oh yeah, I did hear a lot about that. Yeah,
that's a fun, I don't know. I don't even know if it's on TV yet, but that's like a fun nothing to do.
I think
HBO rainy day movie
that. It might be on VOD. I'm not 100% sure. I know that film like hit theaters and kind of it might have hit theaters and VOD at the same time. It kind of came and went, though.
It's one of those movies where you can, you know, almost script it out before you sit down to watch it, but it's still fun.
It's still good.
And it randomly has like a great cast, like Kristen Stewart, Vincent Cassell.
Mm.
I think John Gallagher Jr. is in it.
Jeez. That might be how I felt about The Assistant. Now that I think about it more, it was a tiny film, but it's a really important film when you think about like Harvey Weinstein's trial's been going on and things like that. So being able to have a film that quietly just puts you as a fly on the wall inside of a particular executive producer's office environment, mm-hmm. that has that type of scandalous, you know, like, why are these young women around here? What are they doing here? Oh, there's a new one every week. Like, and seeing this one woman having to deal with that as an assistant in that environment. It wasn't like huge cast. Julia Garner was in it, who I think people probably recognize most from Ozark. Your man's Matthew McFadden from Succession had a scene in the film as well. But like he might be the most recognizable face in the film. But it's almost more intense than you think it would be, especially for a film that you don't really get to see. It's not focused on the actual like allegations or the events. It's just being in that environment and living with that. And, you know, seeing someone really trying to cope with that. It's dropped at the end of January, really quietly.
So before we read off our list of actual cream of the crop, though, I want to do one more. Like, we talked about stuff that, you know, we liked for what it was.
Yes.
Now I want to highlight some of the pleasant surprises, which were two movies from two of our generation's biggest A-listers,
mm-hmm.
who I think everyone has almost written off at this point. Bad Boys 3,
yeah,
was a pleasant surprise.
Mm-hmm. I really like that movie.
And Ben Affleck's The Way Back.
I've still not caught The Way Back, but I've heard good things about it. That was fun.
It's you know, it's just a straightforward, you know, heartwarming sports movie. Affleck's really good in it.
Mm-hmm.
His promo run about how it was this almost art imitating life situation was a little manipulative.
It was a lot.
I didn't really watch it and feel like he was working through his issues in that regard. I think there's almost just a point where Ben Affleck has almost broken the fourth wall.
Yeah.
Like, you look at a movie like Triple Frontier, and he's playing, like, a washed-up guy chugging back beer, like, you know? Like, he just...
as being a guy who probably just chugged some beers the night before.
He's just going for it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you look at Bad Boys 3. We've talked about this extensively, so I'm not going to dwell on it.
We got a whole episode about it in the chamber.
I love that franchise. I love Will Smith. I love Martin Lawrence. I had less than high hopes.
No, yeah. Movie. Honestly, yeah.
And I rewatched it in quarantine too, even though we saw it in theaters. And the first half confirms those fears.
Yes, yes.
And then it turns up.
It's like it's the first like 45 minutes. I remember looking at my phone like, this is still going on while we were in the screening. But
those first 45 are real cringe.
Yeah, and once they make that turn, it's what you wanted the film to be, what you hoped the film would end up being. So,
exactly.
Yeah, and hopefully there's I can't even talk about sequels to that at this point. Who's even going to be filming anywhere? People really don't even know right now.
All right, Cal, let's get to the highlights. And this conversation has been too dire.
Well,
what are your best films of the year so far?
I mean, I get my top tier.
Mm-hmm. Top tier, no participation trophy. It's decent. No, I was home. I had nothing better to do.
The first film I saw that I really felt like that this year was The Five Bloods.
Shout out to Spike.
That's a top five, unless there's four or five crazier films in this film right now. coming out, I feel like that's going to be top five at the end of the year. It's got to be. It's Spike. It's amazing act. I mean, Delroy does his thing, but like top to bottom, it's a really good ensemble work. The violence, the way they shot the war stuff in that film on the 8mm, whatever the film reel was, to catch that vibe of when, you know, people, you were actually seeing that footage from back in the day, I thought was really slick. It was just an excellent film. Spike's career like starts high and it dips a little at some points. And I think he's on a wave of, you know, a really uptrend. And I think this film proves that I don't know if he's got an Irishman in him. I don't know if he's even worrying about stuff like that, but I think if he does and he was ready, Netflix just give him a bag and let him do it. After The Five Bloods, I'm looking at Saint Maud, which is a film I think only press saw Saint Maud so far. Charm City Kings is on that list as well. I love The Gentleman. And, you know, another VOD surprise for me that is making my top five so far is Miss Juneteenth. Shouts out Nicole Beharie.
Shouts out. Everyone go back and watch Sleepy Hollow.
Mm.
The first season.
Facts. She's been putting in work. A
weirdo show y'all slept on. yeah, I think you raised a great point about Five Bloods. And it actually, Five Bloods was a formative experience for me in terms of pandemic viewing, because, like I was joking about before, it was one of those, you have, 36 hours to watch this or whatever. It's a long-ass movie at that. You're stuck in the crib. We're working. It's hard to, like, find that window where you can really watch it and zone in on it. And that film and how much it, the impact that it had on me was proof that you can still enjoy a movie in these environments.
Yeah.
In the setting.
It's almost like a good film can stand on its own no matter what.
Well, it just confirmed to me, because, you know, I would watch other things. Like, I would watch King of Staten Island, which, again, I thought was just okay. It was cool. And I'd be like, man, am I not enjoying this because I had to watch it right now on the Sunday and people are texting me and
yeah, you almost feel forced.
I want to catch The Last Dance. So I paused it and then resumed it. Like, did I fuck myself over watching it broken up?
Mm.
And then I'm watching Five Bloods and I'm like, I had to pause it to do an interview that was scheduled. I had to do this, had to do that. And the two or three times I had to like truncate it or whatever, it still worked.
It's a good film. It's a really goddamn good film. Can you hit me with your top five?
So we have a little bit of overlap. I also have Charm City Kings and Five Bloods on there. Gentlemen as well. And then the last two rounding my favorite out are Palm Springs, which just dropped last weekend, and Promising Young Woman, which is going to go down as the screening you wish you didn't curve.
That's the one film I've not seen that sounds like one of the best films of the year. And
yeah, I mean, I think I'm not ranking anything right now. I only have like six or seven films that I would call really dope so far this year. But I think Promising Young Woman could go down as my favorite right now and will be like a top five.
And that,
that's all said and done.
That's
but I'm also, it makes me anxious too. I'm like, man, am I like overrating this film? Like, I want other people to see it so I can talk about
it. But you're not alone though, right? I think there are some of our peers who had the same energy that you had when you saw it back then as well.
Some of them. I don't know too many people that saw it. It was, I think I saw it in like February and it was set to come out around April.
Oh, that's right. That's
like
right.
That, so.
Yeah, I might have had a March. I think the March screening I had was after we got sent home.
Right.
Quarantine. So yeah, I wasn't going to be able to make that. But yeah, I want to see that. Palm Springs, at least Palm Springs hit Hulu, right?
Yeah, so Palm Springs, for those who don't know, new film with Andy Samberg. He didn't write it, actually, which took me by surprise. When I first heard about it, I thought it was one of the types of films that he cooks up with his Lonely Island boys, like Popstar, which is a cult classic.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's starring and producing in it. And it was one of the highest sales at Sundance. I think it might have broken records. It broke a record by 69 cents, I think. $17 million and 69 cents. But yeah, it was, I read a really great profile with him over the last week. And, you know, he was talking about how he's not like as beloved as he is in Hollywood. He's not like a big box office guy.
Yeah.
So with it breaking that record, there was pressure on him to have a big opening weekend that is now alleviated by just hitting Hulu. So that's like one upside to the situation, even though he would want the movie to come out in theaters and have that, you know, theatrical release.
And that probably could
have that come with that.
For a guy who's been really riding high on the acclaim of a Brooklyn Nine-Nine, this probably could have been one of the more interesting times for him to drop a film just to test the waters and see if he could convert that TV audience to a movie going audience.
Right. But, it plays great at home. Mm-hmm. It's a really fun original film. The buzz out of Sundance had me really hyped to see it to the point where I tried to go into it cold right before I watched our screener, a trailer drop that kind of confirmed that has Groundhog Day trappings. And I was like, you know how I get.
Surprised you watched the trailer.
I didn't watch the trailer, so I think someone mentioned it to me. I was like, "Oh, fuck, thanks." Like, you know me; I like to go in ice cold if possible. Mm. Like, if I'm committed to seeing it like that much, and I love Andy Samberg, I don't want to know anything. So, but even knowing that one detail, that's basically just the base premise. Mm-hmm. It's a really fun and unique rom com, and it's a really interesting performance from him. It definitely has him trying some new things that we're not used to seeing from him. It's very acerbic.
Damn.
The humor in there, you know, it definitely gets a little dark and nihilistic at points.
From Andy Samberg, that's interesting.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, so the conceit, it's Groundhog Day, but it opens with him already kind of having been in it.
Oh, okay.
He's already got this, like, pretty jaded affectation, everything that's going on.
He's living, what was the guy, was the guy's name Charlie in Russian Doll?
Yes.
Yeah, he was a guy.
Time loops are all the rage right now.
It's a thing. It's definitely a thing. But it's cool to see it in a movie where it has a beginning, middle, and an end, as opposed to a show that.
Right, and you know, Palm Springs has some opposite Kristen Nailty, who she's been killing it.
Yeah.
Recently, I mean, for all the How I Met Your Mother fans who listen to this podcast, I don't know how many there are.
Four.
But she was one of the highlights of that show's dark later years.
Word.
And she's just been popping up here and there, but always crushing it and leaving an impression when she does. Like, when, you know, we think of her playing Leo's first wife in Wolf of Wall Street, or that great Black Mirror episode. She was in an episode that was immediately shot up to top five Black Mirror in the USS Callister episode.
Mm-hmm. I just watched that the other day. What a good... It still holds up, too. Really...
Still holds up.
Really, really good episode of television there.
And then another, so an overlap we had was The Gentlemen.
Yes.
That randomly might have been the film I've seen the most.
I've not gone back and rewatched it, but I remember having a lot. I might have put it on once at work, but I remember having a lot of fun with that film.
Well, so we went to an early screening.
Super early.
In 2019, actually, I think it was.
It might have been the end. It was the first 2020 film we saw, and I think it was right before the holidays.
Yeah, so we saw it early, and then they had screenings closer to the release.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, oh, fuck it, I really like this, so I'll go see it again. And then, you know, just looking at movies to watch, you know, especially like pretty much all there is to do, especially at the top of quarantine, mm-hmm. is movie night. So I was like, oh, I think, you know, Carisa might fuck with this. And then ran it back. So I've seen The Gentlemen three times now.
Crazy. I should run it back again.
I was surprised to see some people didn't like it and kind of felt like it was just like a rote version of Guy Ritchie.
Mm.
I enjoy it. I think the characters are really richly drawn, and you don't really get that too much these days. Like,
no.
Jumping into, if people do make a crime thriller, it has like way more stock cardboard characters.
Yes.
It's rare to leave an original crime movie these days and be like, oh, I still want to spend time with these people.
Yeah.
I like that it's not a franchise, but I wouldn't be mad if they made a sequel.
If you want to make some spinoffs or something with just exploring their worlds before they got there, I'm with it, Guy Ritchie.
Like, Hugh Grant kills it in them.
Hugh Grant is amazing. You almost forget that, like, you're watching a movie and then you get back to him and you're like, shit, I still have, like, you know, another half hour with him being amazing. Hugh Grant's
the big
really good.
Guy, Jeremy Strong.
Jeremy Strong is really great in that film. Colin Farrell's really good in it.
You want to talk about surprisingly good performances? A movie that we both have, Charm City Kings, which, again, we caught an early screening of. It was set to come out a couple months later.
Yeah.
And obviously, I don't know what they're planning to do with it. It has been pushed back. I don't know if they're going to acquiesce to VOD or wait for theatrical, but...
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're not going to be dickheads and go too much into it.
Word.
But Meek Mill
was good.
Really, really good in that.
I like it, and it was one of those things where, sure, the character was kind of like
him.
Like, if I were to talk to Meek Mill about what he thinks about the world and the streets right now, it would be dude in Charm City Kings, but it's still a strong performance. Has he acted before?
And nothing substantial.
I don't think I'd seen him in nothing with more than a couple lines, if he's done anything. With the screen time that he had, which was a good amount, he was very good in that film. I mean, yeah. But it was him as well as, you know, really dope ensemble of kids.
Oh, for sure.
It was a really good time, and I like the story. The films like that, that it's, there's so many coming of age in the hood tales. And we've lived through 5 seasons of The Wire, let alone other shows that are on TV, but it's still dope to get a show that really feels like where it's set in. You know, it felt like we were in that bike scene.
Super lived in. The bike scenes are great. Meek is not even playing. Meek is playing someone with like a much more nuance and you know, almost wisdom to impart and like wariness.
Yes.
That really highlights, you know, it's not like when DMX used to act and you'd be like, oh, he's DMX. DMX. Like he's barking at people and busting his gap.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's really cool. And Meek definitely has to come on the pod.
Yeah, yeah.
And discuss getting into his thespian bag. Yeah, so I don't know what's up with the Dream Chasers, what's in the water over there, but they're getting in their thespian bag because Meek's boy Chino is in Charm City Kings 2 and makes a really impressive screen debut.
Yeah, I remember, you know, conversations about him there being talk of other, you know, Dream Chasers guys in the film. I wouldn't have assumed that the character Chino played was, I thought that would have just been like a dope new actor I've not seen before yet, let alone, you know, a whole ass signed Dream Chasers artist. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, it was really impressive to see him really take that and own it and really make it his own for not being somebody you see acting a lot.
I mean, just in keeping with movies that we had the privilege to see while they were still being rolled out and were not officially released and whose fates are still up in the air. Like I was saying before, I think Promising Young Woman is, at least right now, mm-hmm. my favorite movie of the year. And again, not gonna be a dickhead and get too much into it or talk around it in obvious ways. But the basic premise of that movie is Carey Mulligan mm-hmm. is the lead, and it's a movie that tackles Me Too in one of the most unique ways that I've seen so far.
Okay,
and to kind of give you an idea of the tone and where it goes with it. It's created, but it was written and directed by the woman who wrote Killing Eve.
Oh, okay.
Season 2 of Killing Eve, mm-hmm. I should say. Not Phoebe Waller-Bridge, obviously, but Emerald Fennell. Mm-hmm. And so it has, let's just say that Carrie has some real Villanelle vibes.
Okay.
And it poses some really interesting questions and has some other really great performances. Bo Burnham is in it, who, ooh. For those who don't know, Bo Burnham is a rising star. He wrote and directed A24's 8th Grade, mm-hmm. which was a critical darling. He directs stand-up specials for the likes of Gerard Carmichael or mm-hmm. Chris Rock. So this has him just acting, and he does a really good job as a romantic foil.
Okay.
There's like sequences in the movie that I can just already picture becoming like cult classic fan favorite shit.
Yeah.
There is a needle drop that specifically speaks to me uh-uh. as a fan of the OC in that era. So that's all I'll say on that. But
when you talk about needle drop speaking to you, it can only go like 2 or 3. It's either Hove or it's Fleetwood Mac or it's like, I don't know.
Some super pop shit.
Sky Ferrer or however you say homegirl's name.
There, I do not want to spoil this needle drop, but there is a very fun needle drop in Promising Young Woman. And I think, you know, people get not jealous of us, but they think we're living large with the screener access shit. But a lot of times it just makes it, you know, isolating to have no one to talk to about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm literally just, like, I'm not being patronizing when I say I can't wait for people to see these things. I want to discuss it.
It's the same, we had to schedule a meeting just so he and I could talk about Euphoria, like a month or two before it hit HBO, just so we could try and figure out who and what the conversation about the show is going to be. And knowing that that show blew up the way it did, that's a perfect example of being like, hey, I've got this screener. It sucks that I have to wait 3 months for everybody else to see this show.
Yeah.
But
so again, you know, Promising Young Woman is obviously not Black Widow. It can thrive on a VOD setting. Again, I get like let me look this up. I want to say this is Emerald's directorial debut.
Okay.
Yeah, looks like it is. Mm-hmm. And you know, so would you want your directorial debut to not come out in a movie theater?
Facts. No, you're not wrong. You're not wrong at all. If anything, that first film that you make, especially something that sounds like it's this good, it should at least be able to grace a silver screen once
in its life. And it's been a while since we saw Carey Mulligan on the screen in a big role, I think.
Word.
So this is definitely one that's going to cause a lot of interesting conversation.
Okay. Well, shit, fingers crossed. I guess, you know, we don't want to shit on everything that we didn't like, but I think it does make sense to highlight some of the worst films that we caught this year. The one I ranted on probably immediately after I left the theater, I remember being at work trying to hold myself back from really diving into this film, but The Turning, I pray that nobody wants to see this film anymore.
I can't think of a time that you've ever told me a film was so bad you don't want me to see it.
You went to school to like learn about, you know, like how to develop story and structure and things, have a beginning, a middle, and an end. This feels like a part one to a part two that's going to become the. If the movie ended, I don't know if there's an ending. I don't understand. It didn't make any sense. There's a point where it goes from like, this is a really dumb movie to you're not even respecting the laws that you guys made in the last hour or so.
Okay, so that was going to be my question. It's going to be, even if it doesn't have good story beats, was it at least enjoyable up until that point? But it sounds like it was.
No, I think... there were a lot of, it was like they set it in a weird time frame, and there's certain movies that they'll set it in like the 80s or the 70s. Like, yeah, it makes sense. It's drawing what's the Roma?
Uh-huh.
There was a reason as to why it was set at that time frame in that space. This film is set in, it's set in the 90s. Nirvana's popular, but like it has no bearing on what's going on right now, aside from you're going to notice how people dress.
Finn Wolfhard, so mad, and I love it.
Finn Wolfhard's in it. Brooklyn Prince is in it from the Florida Project. They play the kids who were kind of wild. If you've seen the trailer, you see those kids. They're going crazy. I wanted this movie to be better for them because I'm really big fans of them as actors and performers. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know if you sat through Capone.
No, I have not sat
through. I sat through Capone.
There was a lot of farting?
People sometimes make it cliche to shit on a movie or call a movie trash because everyone's calling it trash. And, you know, a lot of people, especially critics in our space, like to be the ones that stand out and say that, oh, you know, it actually has this deeper shading if you really look at it. Mm-hmm. And everyone's just a hive mentality. It's bad.
It's bad, bro.
It's not good. It's not a good movie. It's Tom Hardy sucking on cigars like Bugs Bunny and a carrot stick.
Is he at least good?
No. I mean, he's an artiste.
He performs.
Tom Hardy is a thespian. He makes specific choices. You're never going to get a dull performance from him. You're always going to get the most thought out, wildest but still restrained version of a character that he can get. And sometimes it works well. I think a movie like Venom completely falls apart without Tom Hardy.
Yes.
And the bizarre decisions that he's making in there. He's almost like a student of what Johnny Depp does in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, 100%.
When you think back, you know, it's crazy to contemplate now, but that what he does in that first movie was such a big risk, and people were like, what the fuck is this? Mm-hmm. And they decided to let him cook, and it became this really almost instantly iconic performance.
Yeah.
So Tom Hardy's kind of from that same school of thought, and you know, I appreciate him so much. Again, I don't know if Capone would have been watchable without him at least trying, but the end result of what's on the screen is like a Voldemort
word
growling and spitting and shitting. There are 2 to 3 scenes of extreme defecation.
You actually see it?
Yeah, or hear it. Oh, man, God. It's again, you know, it's trying to paint this portrait of this monstrous, larger than life man, and it's trying to show you the clear contrast and opposite of your picture of like Al Pacino. I mean, not Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, and the Untouchables. Mm-hmm. You know, it wants to really bring him down to size and his last days and show you how far he fell. But maybe it's because it's only set then, but you don't really get that picture.
Yeah.
That full picture of that portrait. It kind of just starts there and just leaves you with 90 minutes of him growling at people.
If you don't read the Wikipedia before going in, you're not going to really get the magnitude if you don't know who he is.
A lot of weirdo dream sequences. He sings along to the Wizard of Oz at one point. Some of it is oddly captivating and hypnotizing, I guess, but
it's still Capone.
There's no redeeming qualities in there, and you know, I think people want to ride for Josh Trank because of the way that he has been done dirty in the industry.
Yes.
In some regards, like when you look at Fantastic Four and all the bullshit that went on with that, and you know, it's the films of his that aren't good don't always seem like it's just his fault that they aren't good.
Yeah.
And to say nothing of New Mutants.
Which is still in limbo.
Coming out in 2025.
Maybe. They said they were dropping it. They said they were dropping it. I don't know.
You know, if this is like a passion project of his, it didn't hit.
Yeah. I kind of felt that way. I'm not going to go too in-depth because this movie is not worth it. But I kind of felt that way about John Henry, which is another...
What the fuck is John?
You never saw John Henry. John Henry was, and it's the way 2020. It makes sense that this man would have one of the worst movies of the year. It's Terry Crews, him and Ludacris. Okay. They both star.
What?
Terry Crews and Ludacris.
You've already painted a ridiculous.
They star
Terry Crews and Ludacris.
Terry Crews and Ludacris star in this movie that I believe they also produced.
Okay.
It's supposed to be. And you've heard the story of John Henry, the steel driving man. I think Terry Crews, who plays a character named John Henry, is supposed to be inspired by that.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially,
Ludacris plays someone called Hell.
Yeah, he plays this guy called Hell. For most of the movie, you see him with like this gold plate. It looks like he has a gold sideburn on his face. There's little to no explanation as to why throughout the majority of the movie. And then when you finally figure it out, it's like, oh, yeah. Okay, it's the acting's bad, the writing's bad. It has a story, but it's just all around not good. The best part about this film is the fact that DJ Quick, I think, did the entire score and all the music for the film.
Shout out Quick!
Shout out to them because again, I'm pretty sure they produced it. I'm hoping they gave him all the money he asked for to make. I think it was like 5 or 6 songs for this film. I know it hit theaters. I think it definitely hit video on demand. I watched it one day after I watched The Grudge because I think I hated myself. Right now,
first of all, I'm going to stop you there. I just want to point out to the people that Cal, if you don't know, is a wild masochist.
You got to watch movies.
I'll watch some shit knowing that I probably won't enjoy it, but just to see what the conversation around it is. Cal is always watching things where I just ask him,
why
are you okay, and why are you doing this to yourself?
I can't be in like what I do is literally try and figure out what the conversation is about these movies and TV shows with our audience. Part of that involves having to subject yourself to mid or lower than mid. You know, The Turning. Or, you know, stuff like Bird Box, where a lot of people are talking about it. If people weren't talking about a film like that, I probably wouldn't rush to see it. But you have to see it because people are talking about it. Just so you can know what you're... Because a lot of people might have liked it. I don't like.
I did watch Bird Box, but I did avoid Bright.
Mm.
This is a great segue, though. And, you know, we're drawing to a close.
Yes.
So, again, we talked about how you are a masochist.
Yes.
One thing that you know about me that the people should know about me is I have this really strong reaction when I don't like a film and I see people love it.
Yes.
Like, not just, like, love it. And I get so confused and bemused and just erratic.
Just how?
I'm just questioning myself, like, damn, was I bugging? Should I have not tried to watch this at 1 a.m. and they just didn't hit for me?
Word.
And then I'm like, no, I'm not bugging. They're bugging. I don't know what the fuck people saw in The Old Guard.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if it's because Charlize is like one of the reigning queens of action.
It's not even like
that's her only bag. She can come back and still do Oscar-worthy drama next one. I don't know if it's because we love Gina Prince-Bythewood and it's, you know, we need more black women directing. Mm-hmm. Action adventures to begin with, and she shouldn't just be relegated to making Love and Basketball
facts.
And Beyond the Lights.
Big facts.
Great films. Dog. Kiki Layne is also in it.
Mm-hmm.
This movie ain't it. I've been racking my brain trying to think of a comparison, but I can only give you like the time window. There was a time in the late aughts, early 2010s, where we got this kind of sanitized action movie that just didn't really have much in the way of like style or flair to bring you in.
Yes.
And seemed like when it comes to the story, and actually, The Old Guard does have style and flair though.
Yeah, there's some there, yeah.
It doesn't have like the hypnotizing, balletic action sequences of like a John Wick.
Yeah.
Or even Atomic Blonde, which is another Charlize movie that I wanted to like, more than I did.
Yeah.
But
I think that's another film that people kind of overhyped.
Yeah.
Possibly because
of action in that movie is out of this world.
Yes. Yes.
Like, I don't know if I want to watch it again, but if I saw it on cable, I would at least pause for it, check back in here and there. Like, she does that one take.
Yeah. I would,
or whatever.
I'd rewatch that.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So The Old Guard doesn't really have anything like that, mm-hmm. to really like make my neck snap and lose. But there was a time during that window I mentioned where we had these action movies with these plots that felt like they were written by people that like read comic books, but had no idea how to adapt.
Yeah.
Not even just the story, but like the themes of like what makes a comic book story work, you know? And this, it's crazy because this is actually written by the dude who wrote the graphic novel that he's based on.
Yeah.
So it's like, it goes to show you, it ain't that simple as just getting, you know, you're the same dude to write it, because two vastly different mediums, bro. I don't know. This thing just didn't connect. It felt like super thin mythology. Like, there are some writers who really understand mythology and how to make it dope and really intriguing. And this is just like, it just kind of feels like the shit you used to think of like as a kid.
Yeah.
Like when you were like making shit up. I don't know, you know, shit I used to make up as a kid. It's like, oh, there's these people who have been alive for like a super long time.
Since the Crusades. Yeah.
Like, that's it. They no rules or anything like that. They legit just can't die. And people want to study them.
they were because this would have been, if this was in the X-Men or if it was just a Marvel comic, that would be issue number one, it would be the first half of the comic. By the end of the comic, you're gonna get all of that, but then there's gonna be some like real world twist or some like injection of, and then this happens, and you don't really get that.
The plot is so surface level, and I'm not looking for like intricacy.
Mm-mm.
I'm just looking for like dope mythology.
Yes,
like people like. My man Joss Whedon is in the hot seat right now. He might be out of here.
Yeah, yeah.
But that guy knows how to paint like mythologies well, and even just like, even if he's not thinking it all the way through, or like the Lost dudes, like what they have put there on the page at least seems fully fleshed out and dope. And this is just like, you know, a 12-year-old's fucking premise of immortal people, yeah. And they do these missions, and but the government's after them. Yeah,
they just do the right thing. But
one of them just wakes up suddenly they just can't die. Like that's their whole mythology, bro. It doesn't make sense. A person dies, and then all of a sudden they come back to life, and it's like, oh, you're one of us.
Yeah, and then it's easy for
and
die.
It teases interesting things.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's one, you know, it teases about the ways that you could really torture someone.
Yes,
who wouldn't die.
Yes. Yeah. The one sequence I think you're referring to is really, it was really intense when you really start.
Hell
to
yeah,
yeah,
man! I'm like, and it made me like, where is this movie?
Yes.
And so, but I went into this movie really hype. I was really hyped for Gina. I was really hyped to see Charlize kicking ass again. Mm-hmm. You know me, I don't sleep. It's nothing for me. I definitely watch Palm Springs at like 3 a.m.
Yeah.
It's nothing for me to start a movie after midnight. I watch this shit at like 12:15, which is might as well be afternoon for me, and fell asleep within 15 minutes. And then I woke up the next morning like, damn, let me try and film this shit. Just the most tedious watch.
Just to get to the end. And it's not a short film. It's like two. It's
you over
know
what
two.
It reminded me of?
What?
Hancock.
Ah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
And Hancock, again, it goes back to this notion of bad movies that have redeeming qualities. Mm-hmm. Like Will Smith is great as Hancock. Mm-hmm. Will Smith and Charlize have a great chemistry in Hancock. But the fucking, all the mythology around them and some of the ways it spins out into the story just feels so half-baked and kind of like just dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. It's.
And the action itself is unremarkable. And that's what the oligarch is.
Hancock is, it was almost like, it's the blueprint for a film that is all too prevalent on a Netflix or on VOD in general. I say that to say that,
so I watched this movie weeks ago,
yeah.
And was like, nope. But I will happily engage Charlize on it.
Yeah.
If she wants to bless this fucking pod.
Always.
Or Gina Prince Bythewood.
Facts.
That didn't end up happening. But that's whatever. But, you know, this week the embargo lifts.
Mm-hmm.
So I say that to say that, you know, if they're not coming on the pod, I didn't really enjoy this film to a point where I wasn't really enthused on doing any other kind of coverage around it because I didn't think it was very good. The embargo lifts this week and I'm seeing people call it one of the best blockbusters Netflix has ever put out, which, okay, the bars in the subway for that, I guess. I'm seeing people call it one of the best films of the year, one of the best action films of the year. It's bringing the genre back. And, you know, there have been a couple profiles on Gina, which is great. And, again,
deserve it. Well deserved.
She should have had this seat. Mm-hmm. What the action that she directs is dope. It just didn't, you know, it didn't, there's no sequence in here that blew my mind.
None that I remember. No. And there's none that are topping a John Wick.
It's very just straightforward gunfire and slashing and, you know. There's a sequence where Charlize takes on some people by herself, and Charlize is Charlize, yeah. And she has a battle axe, and that's cool, but I never need to see this movie again.
No, never at all. But you know what that means. Old Guard 2, 2023 or something like that.
Yeah, and you know what? I guess I'm just the outlier.
No.
Or we're the, you know.
There's probably some of us, but I think I did see a couple of those headlines, and I was kind of surprised because I did see the film. But it's currently only at a 79%. On Rotten Tomatoes, you have to wonder again if this film, to tie it all together, if this film was released in theaters, I don't think you're getting that same vibe at all. I don't think people are going to the theaters in droves to see this,
right?
Compared to some of the other larger action films, I mean, you know, it's dope that a film like this can come out. And again, everybody who's involved in it being able to do something is awesome, but that doesn't always mean that the film is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I guess just to wrap it up, it's July now. We're past the halfway point. There's no telling what we will get to see when or where we'll get to see it. But there are still some promising things on the horizon, to say nothing of the fact that, you know, the Oscars and everything pushed back their window to include shit. Otherwise, you were looking at shit like Vin Diesel and Bloodshot,
yeah,
being one of the only things eligible for like best actor or some shit. You know, Candyman is gonna be great.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you don't want to see that get pushed back further, but Horror in October kind of is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's Halloween getting the October spot makes sense, but I kind of like the idea that if Candyman can come out in theaters at Halloween, that's the best time, realistically, for it.
Whenever Tenet comes out, I'm sure it'll be great.
Ready. This man's anxious.
Christopher Nolan doesn't really miss. I mean, I didn't love Interstellar, but Interstellar's still dope.
Yeah, yeah. It could
have been. What do we have? We have Coming to America 2.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's nuts.
Big sequel.
Venom 2 is apparently still... Is Venom 2 still around? That had not that had an October release date, and I feel like it's kind of just been waiting.
That's not one of the movies that's getting me out of bed. But the promise of Venom 2 is not what's keeping me going, but hey, sure. We have so many dregs this year, I'll take what I can take.
It'll at the very least, it'll do well at the box
office. Between that and fucking Black Widow.
They're coming out. They're going to be owning the box office whatever weekend they drop. So, and
we need the box office to get back up if we ever want movie going to have any kind of semblance to what it was before.
I will say, I think, and I guess that's kind of like the final cap on this long conversation. It is the idea that once you feel safe enough to hit a theater, especially a theater that might be smaller than some of the regular chains, it's probably just like you would support a local business. You should hit your theaters if you want to see that stuff still thrive, because they're not able to. They can't sustain off of whatever on demand services or stubs. I think a lot of the stub stuff got halted as well, if I'm not mistaken. So, it's there's no
income. Support your theaters.
Yeah, facts. You got to support your theaters.
Support your film bro favorite companies. If you buy an A24 merch, you better be out there when the Green Knight comes out. That shit look crazy.
Yeah.
St. Maud is dope. St. Maud is like a horror twist on First Reformed,
yeah.
To me, kind of.
First Cow?
First Cow is on VOD, but technically that's because it did have a light theatrical release. Very small. Still sticking to their word.
Very small.
Yeah, man. Charm City Kings, Promising Young Woman. These things are going to come out sometime soon, and they are definitely all worth your time. So, you know. Checking in at the halfway mark of what has definitely been one of the weirdest, strangest years of movie going, but with some proof that no matter what happens, the industry is still going to be resilient and turn out some gems.
Facts. Big facts.
All right, well, that does it for this week. For the homie Frazier, it's your boy Cal, advising you as always to stay 6 feet away from anybody that is not in close contact with you. Keep mask on deck. I know for me, it's hard to remember my one. So if you got one that you carry around with you, make sure you put one in the whip or in your backpack, in your back pocket, whatever works. Don't be a dickhead at anywhere. IRL, online. We don't need that type of energy around us. Tune in and watch less.
Peace.
Watch Less is hosted by Frazier Tharp and myself, Cal. Our producer is Taliba Newman. Associate producer and sound engineer is Jasmine Plata. Production manager, Chancel Correa. Talent booker, Anthony Allred. Junior booker, Austin Bailey. Our director of talent relations is Kristen Price Harrell. And our senior director of operations is Jen Stewart. Watch Less is a part of the Complex Podcast Network.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big money.